Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Reflecting on the Death Penalty, Public Policy Questions to Consider. Our presenter is Ingrid Christensen, session number CHI 2006-5. Let's listen in.
Tell you a little first, briefly, why I'm interested in the death penalty. I sort of fell into a job in the year 2000. I quit being a college professor, which I had been for 31 years, in which I taught public policy and a lot of poverty issues, poverty in the law, poverty in the medical system, etc. And I started doing work as a sentencing advocate or a mitigation specialist for people facing the death penalty. The kind of work I do involves researching clients' lives, individual clients. I am independent, so I have an office of my own, and now a couple of other people have joined me in my office who do this work also. And we take cases, lawyers call us up and say, do you have time for another case? And if one of us does, we say yes. We take a case and we normally spend about 2 years, even 2.5 years, working up the history of the person, getting to know the person as well as we can, intimately acquainted with them, to learn about who they are and why they did the terrible thing that they're accused of having done. And most of the time, in fact, have done. There's an occasional innocent person that has not done it. So I gather all the records from the person's entire life. I talk to their parents and their brothers and sisters and their cousins and their aunts and uncles and their neighborhood friends and the people they went to grammar school with and their pastors and their teachers and everyone I can find who knows them well in some way or another. Even there, I go to prisons and interview friends of theirs who are in prison if they have such people. And then after a couple of years, I see the themes in their life that developed in such a way that the path of their life ended up in this awful place where the crime was committed. So I try to figure out, and sometimes the person themselves is someone that I don't think will ever be redeemable. I don't think this person is going to get well from whatever it is, but I know the person can be contained in prison and doesn't have to be executed, and that our prisons are built for people like that. So if we're going to execute them, it can't be because we're afraid of them, in my opinion. But that's a separate issue. Tomorrow, in the death penalty series, we're going to talk about our faith and the relationship of our faith to the death penalty. And then on Friday, again, we'll revisit some of these policy questions and talk about the fact that Jesus asks us all to visit those in prison, and we'll talk a little more about prison and what it's like to be in prison and how you might engage that system. I've put down a partial list here of some of the things I'd like to talk about on today and Friday. I finished my ice cream cone instead of writing the last three, because I don't have any confidence that we'll get to them anyhow, so I'll get the rest of them. There's at least one person in the village, and I would guess quite a few more, who are family members of murder victims. And that's a sort of another question that we can engage and might engage. I've been trained to reach out to family members of murder victims, and I have a separate set of clients where I do that. So I have some knowledge of that, but obviously I could never have the kind of knowledge that someone who's had that experience has. So someone here may elect to talk about that. We also have a great gift in that we have someone here who's been a judge, who's actually been involved in a death penalty case, and he's going to tell us something about the case he was involved in. So we're grateful to Grant for that. I'm going to start, though, by summarizing where the U.S. stands in the global community in terms of the death penalty. And then after I've done that, we can have some discussion and questions, and there's at least one international person in the room who has opinions. And then we'll move on to domestic issues. issues and we'll start taking them one by one. And I'll talk a little bit and you can talk and we'll discuss them. And Grant is going to talk about how the system works because he's been a judge and knows. So there we are. Anything you want to add to the agenda? It's so dark in here, isn't it?
It is
in here?
Dark.
Dark outside.
Somebody could flip. Is that switch on? Dark. It's always dark. I'm always grumpy about this room because it's always dark. I think we should do something about it. But in the meantime, I'm going to sit under a light. Since 1980, excuse me,
and what your glasses are on your head.
On my head?
Uh-huh.
Thank you. My husband isn't here to loan me his, so.
You've been there or done that?
I know. So pathetic, getting old.
Maturing.
There's a global trend toward abolition, toward getting rid of the death penalty. And we're grateful for that, and we're certainly grateful for that when U.S. citizens are arrested on charges abroad for which the death penalty might be a punishment. In the last 30 years, the 40 countries have abolished. Since 1985, 40 countries have abolished the death penalty. And four countries have adopted it. And of the four who adopted it, one then rescinded it again and got rid of it. So they reversed their adoption. No other member besides the United States of NATO has the death penalty. Turkey and Russia fairly recently abolished it, so they were the last to go in that group. Four countries, and since 1985, four countries account for 94% of the executions. The four countries that have done 94% globally, 94% of the executions are China, Iran, the Congo, and eight countries since 1990 had executed children. China, the Congo, Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, and United States. Oh, Yemen. I left Yemen out.
Sorry, Yemen.
So, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Nigeria, Iran, the Congo, and China. United States, and we, until last year, led by far in the numbers of people who we executed who were children at the time of the crime. But now Iran has matched us, come up in numbers. So, aren't you proud, those of you who are Americans? I've had foreign nationals as clients. And one of the striking things about foreign nationals who are arrested in the United States and charged with crimes for which the death penalty is one of the potential punishments, are denied their Geneva Convention rights routinely. They're almost never told that they have a right to call their consulate and that they have a right to let their country know that this has happened to them. Now, you know that if you're somewhat errant nephew was in one of these countries and was arrested, you would really want the U.S. consul to know, and you'd want help for that person. So if you think of the reverse here and why we just flagrantly ignore that law, I don't know, but that's what we do. So I think the U.S., it also causes a lot of problems because a lot of countries, particularly European countries, are trying to put pressure on the U.S. to change their policy, and they don't know how to hold us hostage, but it creates international problems. Of course, course, we don't seem to mind that anymore. We don't, you know, the French, whatever, you know. So those are the few little statistics I want you to know about the U.S. globally. Do you want to comment about that at all?
No, you've covered it perfectly.
Okay.
I'm curious which of the four that recently adopted, but you said one that's in it. What are the newer?
I don't have the information on this sheet of paper, but I do have it somewhere here. The one that rescinded, I think I might have.
The ones that were decided recently.
Right. Do I have it? I'm afraid I don't have it here. Sorry. I think if you stay after, I can probably find it among my things. I looked up a bunch of these numbers.
Curious what sort of culture.
Yeah. There are a couple really good websites where all this information is available. And if you just type in, if you just Google death penalty or global death penalty, some very good sources of information. CapDeathNet.com is one of them, Capital Defenders Network.com. Death Penalty Facts, HTM. murdervictimsforreconciliation.org/deathpenaltyfacts.htm is one where I get a bunch of information. And one is Amnesty, of course, .org, Amnesty International. Why don't you look in here? Do you have good eyes? This article, I think we'll have it, and you can tell us in a couple minutes when you spot it. That's an Amnesty International article.
Yeah, it worked for the answer.
You're not sitting under a light, though, are you?
No, it's all right.
Good. So, any more comments or questions about the global situation? Okay, we'll move on. Domestic. Grant is going to tell us something about his trial and some comments about how the system works in general. Grant, you want to just do that?
Sure.
Thanks.
If you don't mind, I'll sit down.
Please.
I'm used to sitting down on a job.
Yeah.
A lawyer.
He's actually tried a capital case as a judge.
Yes. I live in Port Angeles, Washington. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that place, it's on the Strait of Juan de Fuca, across the strait from Victoria, Canada. I've lived there for over 25 years. I've served as a prosecuting attorney for the county, Clallam County, and I've served as a Superior Court judge in Clallam County, both of which are elective positions, and I think that has at least something to do with public policy. And in this state, which has the death penalty, public policy, the very basic public policy is set out in statutes which are adopted by the state legislature, who are representatives of the people, and in court rules, Supreme Court rules, which are adopted for the use of trial courts by the Washington Supreme Court. And I am familiar with the statutes and the court rules, particularly as they existed from the late 70s and into the early 90s when I was serving in the two positions that I mentioned, prosecuting attorney and Superior Court judge. I think that you should understand that the death penalty as it exists under the state of Washington's law is in some instances as to how it is administered, is done so by two bodies that have a great deal of discretion. And by my use of the word discretion, I mean that the person or the body can make decisions without being answerable or not being very strictly answerable to anyone else. And in the criminal procedure of this state, which includes a death penalty case, the prosecuting attorney, which is an elected official of the county, there are 39 counties in Washington, so there are 39 elected prosecuting attorneys. Each county prosecuting attorney in that county makes the decision, first of all, whether to file a criminal case against a person, and if so, what crime to allege, and if there are different classes or divisions of the crime, what degree of the crime to allege. The prosecuting attorney also has the discretion to enter into plea bargaining with the defender and defense counsel. I don't know if you know much about plea bargaining. It's basically a negotiation between the state, represented by the prosecuting attorney, and the defendant, represented by his or her attorney. And depending upon the strength, the relative strengths of their cases, they may wish to reach an agreement as to what the outcome of the case should be. Without going to trial. And all kinds of give and take and negotiations and horse trading are done in plea negotiations. It can depend upon whether or not the prosecutor wants to take a case to trial at a particular time when it may be set for trial. He may have a vacation set. All kinds of things. Seriously, though, it's very much used by prosecuting attorneys, and it is engaged in by defense counsel as well. And I don't have any statistics on this, but if in this state plea bargaining were somehow disallowed, the courts would not be able to handle all of the criminal cases that there are, and they would be dealing only with criminal cases, and I'm sure they wouldn't even be able to handle them all. Civil cases would be out the door because they wouldn't be able to handle them.
I can tell you that in Cook County, where Chicago is, 95% of the cases, of the criminal cases, are settled through plea bargaining instead of going to trial, including of the capital cases, the cases where the death penalty is at stake. Because if you can plead out a capital case and get natural life, then you don't have to risk the death penalty.
I'm sure that the experience in Washington and in Clinton County is right up there, 95%. And
so most people who get charged with murder don't go to trial.
And there is at least, in my mind, some benefit to plea bargaining. At least the parties retain some control over the outcome of the case. If they go to trial, they hand that control over to someone else, to the jury, if it's a jury case, or to the judge, if it's tried without a jury. And in felony cases in the state of Washington, and I think in all states of the United States, felony cases must be tried to a jury. There's a constitutional right to a jury trial, unless the defendant voluntarily and knowingly decides to give up his or her right to a trial by jury. And in this case, in death penalty cases, the jury is called upon not only to determine the guilt or innocence of the defendant, but if the jury determines that the defendant is guilty, then the jury moves on to determine the punishment of the defendant and then the convicted person. In death penalty cases in this state, as they were prosecuted when I was involved in them, and things may have changed somewhat since then, but I don't think very greatly. There was, of course, plea bargaining. The prosecutor has a great deal of discretion, and, of course, the jury has a great deal of discretion. And particularly in death penalty cases, that discretion leaves, in my opinion at least, the trial judge with little discretion. The trial court judge does not, of course, determine whether a crime has been committed or who committed such a crime, except insofar that judge will review in this state an affidavit filed by the prosecuting attorney, which sets out the facts that the prosecuting attorney says that he or she will be able to prove. And the judge is asked to review that and determine whether there is probable cause to take that person to trial. Probable cause very basically means that is there a reason to believe that would appear in the mind of a reasonable person after knowing all of the evidence to believe whether there probably has been a crime to be committed or has been committed, and whether probably this alleged person, the defendant, has committed it. And the court will make the determination of probable cause, which is a very much lower standard of proof than is necessary to reach a conviction, which is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In a death penalty case, perhaps I should say a backup, that I think in Washington, the use of an affidavit of probable cause and the determination by the judge that there is or is not probable cause, and probably in 99.9% of the cases, the judge says there is probable cause. I can remember only a very few that I've reviewed where I did not find probable cause. But in other states and in the federal government, in most cases, the review of the facts is done by a grand jury. I don't know if that was the way it's done in Illinois or not, but a grand jury will look at the facts as presented to it by the prosecuting authority, in this state, the prosecuting attorney, in the federal system, the attorney for the United States, the U.S. attorney, and the grand jury, a body of 24 persons, will be asked to determine whether or not there's probable cause to hold that person over for trial by a petit jury, a jury of 12 persons. And did you have grand juries? Yeah. And they return, I'm sure, findings of probable cause in 99.9% of the cases as well. In any event, I'm sorry?
We don't have them in all cases. I don't know what cases we have.
So tell us about your trial.
Okay.
And the grand jury, are they composed of public?
They're composed of citizens.
This is a regular jury.
They're drawn in this state now after some revisions to the law that would include a wider body. They include registered voters and persons who hold driver's licenses. And so though by not voting, you can't escape jury duty now.
Has anybody here ever been called on a grand jury?
Well, yeah,
a grand jury?
Into the pool, but not, didn't serve on it.
Uh-huh. What state?
Texas.
Into a Texas grand jury or a federal?
Texas.
Texas, okay. There's a, and I have no idea whether it's still the belief, but there's a rumor, an old wives' tale among prosecuting attorneys in this state, that it's bad luck to use grand juries. Prosecuting attorneys can call grand juries in this state to review for probable cause, but very rarely do, because it seems that prosecuting attorneys tend to get in trouble when they do that for various reasons. And so they merely present the affidavit for probable cause to the judge, and the judge makes a determination of probable cause. Let me just review first, very briefly, what I consider to be public policy points, since that's the topic of this session, with regard to the death penalty cases in this state. This state, as I mentioned, has a death penalty. Death penalty is available only for aggravated first-degree murder and for treason in this state. And I don't know of any case that's been brought for anyone who has been accused of treason. Usually that is a federal offense, but state courts can try federal violations of federal law. And when I mentioned this to Ingrid, she told me that you know of some in the federal system that have been accused of treason and the death penalty has been on the table. I don't know of any treasonous cases that have been brought here. So aggravated first-degree murder is first-degree murder, which is the unlawful killing of a human being with premeditation. And premeditation is malice aforethought. That's what it means in law. And there are books and classes in law school taking months to explain what that means. If there is first-degree murder, then the prosecuting attorney may make a determination of whether or not the defendant should stand accused of aggravated first-degree murder. And the aggravation is spelled out in statute. Ingrid mentioned some that apply in Illinois the other day. I'm sure that the list of Washington is like Illinois. Several that I'll just go over are to kill more than one person in a criminal enterprise, to kill a person in the furtherance of another felony, to kill a police officer, a juror, or a judicial officer in the course of his or her duties is a capital offense punishable by death. And there are many others. The case that I was involved in was one in which there were two persons killed in the course of a criminal enterprise. And I think it was also, this happened over 20 years ago, so I don't remember all the details. I think it was also charged in the alternative that it was a killing in the course of another felony, namely theft or robbery. But anyway, that basically is public policy, which is spelled out by the statutes and the court rules of the state of Washington. It's really a quick and dirty public policy review, but are there any questions so far? There's much discretion in the prosecuting attorney and in the jury in this state. Because of the way the law is set out in this state, it's my opinion, and I think you'll find that it's the opinion of most other attorneys in the state and judges, that the judge in a capital death penalty case has little discretion. In any event, the case that I sat on was in Powell County. The defendant's name was Patrick, that was his last name. And Patrick was a Canadian citizen. He had been in prison in Canada for property crimes, as I remember it. And when he was released from prison in Canada, through some faith or Christian organization, a couple retired, I think, a retired couple in Clallam County learned of him and befriended him. And I think the situation was that he needed some supervision under the law of Canada to be released to somebody who could supervise him. And so I think this couple said, yeah, we'll supervise him. And so they befriended him and supervised him. And they had a little farm outside of Port Angeles, and they asked him to do some jobs around the farm. I don't think it was anything onerous. And he was there for a couple of months, I believe. And one day, the neighbors couldn't get a hold of the couple. Their names were Skiff, I think it was. And I remember his name, Philip. I don't remember her. I think it was Inez. Anyway, they couldn't get a hold of Philip and Inez, and somebody went to their home and couldn't find them, couldn't find Mr. Patrick either. And they determined that the Skiff's pickup truck was also missing. And so law enforcement was called, and through some investigation, they found that There were items of this gift's personal property that were missing. I don't think anything big. I don't even remember what it was. And some few hundred dollars of cash that was taken from their home. It wasn't any big amount. And so deduction led to Mr. Patrick, and a warrant was issued for his arrest. And a couple weeks later, he was arrested in a hobo camp near Wenatchee. And he was taken back to Clallam County, charged with aggravated first-degree murder, and was put on trial. After a lot of game playing and motion filing and hearings, pre-trial. This is an aside, one of which I found interesting. His defense counsel wanted to take the deposition of a potential witness in Canada. The defendant has the right to confront witnesses against him, which includes, at least arguably includes, confronting witnesses who testify at a deposition in his case. A deposition is where a person is called to give testimony before a notary public who takes it down on a steno machine with the defense and the prosecution present. That's it. Yeah?
Did you mention where they bought the bodies?
The bodies of the skiffs were found in the bushes on their farm.
Oh.
They were hidden in the brush.
Okay.
In any event, he wanted to take the deposition of someone in Canada, and he argued that he would have a right to appear at that deposition in Canada because he was a defendant and he had the right to confront witnesses, and the witness would be in Canada against him. And we had some fun with that, and the prosecuting attorney was aghast at that because if Mr. Patrick reached Canada, he would say, "You can't send me back to the United States because I am in peril of dying at the hands of the authorities in the United States." I think how it came out was the prosecuting attorney elected not to take the deposition of the person in Canada and called the person through subpoena process to appear at trial. And I think he talked to the person before the person testified at trial. So got around that.
Now we gotta cut to the chase because we've got so much else to do.
Okay, time?
Well, let's finish. What happened? Was the person found guilty or innocent?
Yes, he was found guilty by the jury. And the jury, he did not waive a jury. The jury found him guilty of aggravated first-degree murder. We went to the penalty phase. There wasn't anything extraordinary in the penalty phase. He called witnesses from his family, told the jury that he was such a good guy. Unusual things. Perhaps he should have had anger at somebody like her there. Might have dug up something else.
In those days, there wasn't such a thing as my job.
No. It was done by defense counsel, basically. He was, the jury determined unanimously, which the vote must be, that he should suffer death. And I signed several over the course of my dealings with his case. Death warrants, which are merely a direction to the warden of a penitentiary to put to death this person at a certain time and place, merely enacting what the jury has already determined he should suffer. In the course of the investigation by the defense counsel, I don't know exactly how he found out, but he interviewed jurors and learned that a juror had told other jurors, I believe during deliberations, that Mr. Patrick had been in prison in Canada and was released here in Peru. And my order to the attorneys and to all witnesses was that they were to make no revelation that he had been in jail or in prison in Canada, and they would make no mention of any punishment that he may have suffered, including being under parole. And so there was none. And during the voir dire of the prospective jurors, the questioning of the prospective jurors by the attorneys, there were questions that would have elicited whether or not they knew of his time in prison or whether he had been convicted. And none of the jurors answered the questions affirmatively. So the juror that revealed this to the other jurors had committed perjury. There wasn't any prosecution against that person, but it eventually ended in Mr. Patrick not suffering the death penalty. He died about a year ago of natural causes in prison. And so his penalty was essentially life in prison without parole. That's basically my story. Any questions?
Do you have any sense that that juror might have done that purposefully in some way, so as to, if the death penalty was reached, that?
Oh, I suppose it could have happened. I don't know that that was a part of the thinking.
No way to know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that I'm Grant's wife, and that I remember, he doesn't talk a lot about all this stuff at home, but I remember reading the papers a lot, and there was almost nothing about Mr. Patrick in the paper. You know, we knew that he was a Canadian, but the whole thing was set up to feel sorry for this family, this couple, who through art, that Mr. Patrick was an artist, and they were artists, and they brought him to their home to nurture that artistic part of him, and so there was all this about the skiffs, but we didn't really know anything other than he was an artist, and, you know, people were doing these things, so.
So he signed a death warrant, and then the case was overturned because of the juror, and then the man died in prison. And the man may have died in prison even if that hadn't happened. But the one last thing that I'd like to emphasize, or there are two more things I'd like to emphasize about Grant's work in that case. One is that he had no choice. If he was going to serve as a judge, he would have to agree to uphold the law, and this was the way the law worked. He took an oath. So at the point where he signed a death warrant, the jury had made that recommendation. The jury had the right to do that. And he, as a judge upholding the law, had to sign the death warrant. So he was in a position of being on automatic pilot at that time. And the second thing I want to emphasize is that he says, you know, in a very self-deprecating way, that he didn't do anything very important there. And I said that I thought that I want good people to serve as judges, and people who have a conscience, and people who are thoughtful about their work, because he made, in that case, probably 1,000 decisions along the way that were fair. And there are a lot of judges that are not fair. And so having someone like him in that chair as judge, who listens to every question that he has to decide that comes to him from the two sides, because it's an adversarial system, you have to make those choices constantly. One side argues one thing, the other side argues the other thing. The judge has to make a fair and balanced decision. So I want good people, even good people who are very uncomfortable giving the death penalty, to sit as judges. So I think I owe him an ice cream cone.
Yeah.
Thank you. I really appreciate you doing that.
Now,
a question like a case like that, would go to trial rather than to the plea bargain.
Well, you're
in that 5% or so that don't go to a jury, are they assuming they're going to get off because they're either innocent or they have some mitigating factor?
I can tell you, in my case, we had a very gung-ho prosecuting attorney who wanted the death penalty.
Wouldn't let it be plea bargain.
Lots of prosecuting attorneys. That comes to the point F down here. Lots of prosecutors, and they're the ones that have the control over taking or not taking a plea. And they have reason to want to appear in the newspapers every day or be hard and tough on crime, or, you know, they're political. It's a political thing.
It's an elected position. Right?
It's an elected position.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've known myself, personally, prosecutors who have wanted to use that as a platform to run, say, for governor or
right.
for other things. So.
Right.
So there is a reason to want to appear, be able to be on the evening news every day and be tough on crime and things like that. that. So that can sometimes be a political decision.
It's not the defendant's decision.
It's not the defendant. Well, if the it's a defendant's decision if the prosecutor says, we're willing to plead this out. And the prosecutor and the defense attorneys can talk to each other and say, we'd like to get this pled out. I had one of those cases this year where everybody agreed, all the grown-ups agreed, we need to plead this out. But the kid had in his mind that an assistant state's attorney who took his statement on the night of the affair, of the crime, promised him 30 years. And he said, I want that because no state's attorney would agree that they had promised this kid 30 years on the night of the crime if he would give a statement and go on videotape and say what he had done. So nobody agreed, everybody denied having made that promise to the kid. And the kid said, I want that person to burn in hell. And so I want them to come into court during my trial and swear on a stack of Bibles that they didn't say this, so that God hears them and takes them to hell. Mm. Took me about a year to talk about that.
It's very frustrating.
So, you know, now and then a defendant, you know, and then you say to the defendant, you've got professional help here, you know. These people are being paid because they're experts and they're on your team and they're on your side. You should trust them. But, you know, the defendant, I mean, there's a saying in prison, which is true, you know, who's got to do the time? You know, are you going to do the time? The one who does the time can make the decision. And this kid was going to do the time. So he wouldn't take the plea until 2 days before trial he took the plea. After we'd done all the prep, which is a lot. Any more questions for Grant?
Can a judge ever overturn a jury decision?
Yes.
In what are those circumstances?
When, in the judge's opinion, there is no law or facts that will allow the jury to reach the decision they did. In other words, you have to take the law and the facts most favorably to the non-moving party.
Well, have you ever had that
you made the statement that there are some judges that aren't fair. And in the state of Washington, and I'm sure it's true, I know it's true in other states, but I only know about it in Washington, we're very eager to hold the standards of the judiciary to the highest level. And there is a state commission on judicial conduct whereby everything that ever comes, anybody can present. There's a process by which you can complain about judges' behavior, and there's a whole system by which this is looked at, and the final outcome comes to, it's not publicized so that just because somebody doesn't like, he's sitting in jail and he wants to complain, so that a lot of them are like that, and there isn't anything. But the final outcome is then, when there's some question at all, it comes to this big panel of which I'm part.
I was just going to say, and Peggy, do you know anyone who sits on this panel?
Mostly judges and lawyers, and some of them are ordinary people like me, and then we go over very carefully to uphold and protect the judges to the highest level, mm-hmm. and to protect the public's trust in the judges. Mm-hmm. So I'm would hope other states do this, and I suppose Washington makes some mistakes, but the efforts are certainly there.
And we're glad that you serve on that. Thank you for doing that. That's great. I'm afraid not every state does that.
Is that right?
Let's put the states up on the machine so we can just see what states, the 38 states have the death penalty. And yeah, thanks. Great.
What was
get rid of
faster.
We do.
We do.
It cleared them out.
And the reason that Illinois is so low, down to 9, is that we are the people that our Governor Ryan in 2003 exonerated 166 people, and I mean, not exonerated, he commuted the sentences of everybody on death row. 166 got commuted and put given life in prison, and 4 got exonerated and released. And as some of you know, one of the 4 was one of mine. So he was an innocent person.
Uh-huh. What was the process that the states followed that do not have the death penalty? How did that come about? What was their decision?
The legislature of each state?
Yeah, it's a law. It's a legislative decision in each state. And the federal government, especially under Attorney General Ashcroft, that I imagine of continuing under Gonzales, although I don't think he's spoken to it, is in favor of all states having it. And so when there is a federal case that can be, a federal death case that can be tried in a non-death state, for example, Minnesota or Wisconsin or North Dakota, then the feds have a preference for trying a death case in that state, much more than they would say in California or Texas or Florida, because they want people in each state to have the experience of the death penalty, and you can bring a federal case in any state. You can also have a military case come from any state.
So it's really the will of the people, because, you know, percentage-wise, it's a large percentage, it still supports the death penalty.
It's around in the low 60%, now 63% or something. Wisconsin is facing a vote this fall, this November, about whether or not to have the death penalty. Wisconsin does not have it, and there is some thought that in that referendum they will get it.
And you take a poll of people in churches, and they're pretty similar. I mean, at least in the ELCA, they're still pretty similar to the polls in the general public.
I don't want to mislead you about Wisconsin. The referendum is only, isn't a referendum that's not, it's a non-binding referendum. So the legislature would have to vote, but they want the advice of the voters. And so that's what's being voted on.
So, how many appeals does somebody get on when they're on death row?
Is it a state or a federal case.
Okay.
Theoretically, you can have 9 levels of appeal if you're a state case.
Okay.
And 3, I believe, if it's federal, is that right?
Sure, yeah, basically.
Just up to the Supreme Court. So in Illinois, before we got those 170 people off death row, the average amount of time it took for someone to be executed after they were given the death penalty was 11 and a half years of those who were executed. Increasing numbers of people were not being executed because they would be found innocent. So that's another issue. We'll talk about the innocence issue. Let's go to the second of these.
Is this the one that you put on? Which way is up?
Opaques.
And in Illinois, I think I was there when Ryan exonerated them, but then I don't. We left in the beginning of the 90s. Was there ever a referendum?
No. No, we still have the death penalty. We're refilling death row, but we're still not executing people. We're waiting until we finish fixing it. Theory. One of the things, I don't think I wanted to do the race.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. What is it you want?
That one. The size of death row by years between 1968 and the present is sort of interesting. You can see that it went way down when the Supreme Court ruled against the death penalty until it got fixed, and that rule was fixed in 1976. So the numbers were dropping and dropping, and then in 78 was the first year it started going up again.
75, it's 48, it's gone up.
Yeah, I wonder how to, well, maybe it was 75 when that changed. I thought, in Illinois, I guess it might have, I don't know. I think it was states' rights. I think every state, once the Supreme Court changed its opinion, then every state
had to do it.
Yeah. So those are the numbers on death row. I think it is important to think about what was going on in the country when we had such a small amount of death penalties. In 72, 74, you know, I was a anti-war activist and an anti-civil rights activist and a women's rights activist, so I was all involved in all those movements. And we all had a wonderful time. But that was here. And there was so much unrest in the country. And everybody was so, you know, there were demonstrations in the streets, and there was all this stuff going on. But there was relatively little. I mean, if you looked at not just the death row population, I should have the other graph. There's a graph of incarceration. The incarceration graph is very similar to this one, in the general incarceration. So during that time, there wasn't a lot of taking people to court and people getting the death penalty and stuff. But then we started to really grow, 80, 82, 84. So whatever was going on in the in the country at that time is when we really started shooting up in this. I wish I had that other graph to show you about incarceration, because it's very close to this one, the way it works. So those are some kind of statistical things about our history. All right, then let's stop this for now. We'll get on to those other ones. So let me talk to you about the innocent. One of the policy problems is that innocent people, one of the reasons that we have a hard time with the death penalty is because innocent people are found to be on death row at a sort of unnerving, large quantity. Since 1973, 122 people who have been tried in the process we've been hearing about, convicted, sentenced to death, and somewhere in the process of their appeals, 122 of them in the United States have been found to be innocent. And of course, since the advent of DNA, that number popped up. False confessions, people confess to these crimes at an astonishing rate. Many, many, many people confess to having done terrible murders who are innocent of them.
Why do they do that, sir? I mean, I've heard of that before, but why would you do that?
There's a lot of research about why they do it, and people conduct double-blind studies about it all the time. My experience is that they do it because they get talked into believing they did it. One reason. They become sleep deprived, and they're frightened, and they're cut off from their loved ones, and they're incarcerated, and there are mean people around them. And you know, after a day or two or three, it's usually after about 2 days, they say they did it. Another reason is a lot of them are tortured. Well, in Illinois, we had torturers that were specialists in torturing people into confessions, and the kind of torture that they did, including my client, who was one of the four exonerated, was a police captain called John Burge, was in charge of one of the police districts on the south side, which was a very poor neighborhood. And they had a box that was used evidently in the field of Vietnam, where you'd crank it, and it was a way to get enough energy to send a phone message in the field in Vietnam during the war. They had one of those in this police station. And they would crank it and use the electricity to shock people on their genitals. And they put cattle prods in their rectums. And they had in those days we had typewriters. They had plastic typewriter cover that they would close over their heads until they would pass out. And then once they passed out, they'd revive them and start over again. So there were, over 100 people were victims of this, and finally the stories started to emerge. So a number of people confessed because they just wanted it to end. But there are that's not the only place where various kinds of coercion are used. Police can take a course in how to persuade people to confess. So it's a field of study, so you can get good at it. I've thought about taking the course, actually.
You mentioned too that the younger people sometimes took an offense of an older person,
yes,
in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
So they would also be people who are innocent.
Yes, that's in Chicago. It's very common that in gang situations or in large family gang-like structures. If you're under 12, you're coerced by your gang or family to take the rap for an older friend or cousin or brother or something on a murder, because the older person would have had to do 40 years and you have to do 5 years if you're under 12. So, you know, there's that. But of course, if you're under 12, you're not a candidate for the death penalty. But then that becomes that prior becomes the thing that makes you eligible for the death penalty if you're caught on another murder later in life. So for whatever reason, people do confess. And often they confess in ways that the police have given them the answers to the questions, so that they, you know, I had a kid who was barely literate who confessed. And he confessed in this very odd language. I mean, this kid could barely speak, you know. He spoke very ghetto language. And he confessed in this kind of normal language. And I showed the videotaped confession to his family, and they said, that ain't Curtis talking, that ain't Curtis, you know, because it didn't sound like him. But he'd learned these phrases from the prosecutors, and then he just sort of spit them out.
Wow. You'd like to think that the innocence would come out of the first trial or the first appeal. Does it ever? Yeah, hope, you know, that allegation get overturned.
One of the reasons that so many people were found innocent, 14 people were found innocent in Illinois during the same period as the 12 people were executed. And so, and this was before DNA. So this was, you know, started, that's why Governor Ryan got so nervous. Maybe it wasn't before DNA. I guess DNA had started to enter in there. But three of the people who were found innocent because a journalism class at Northwestern University adopted their case for a year. And this group of students, every year a different class of journalism students, had as their year-long project to investigate a case that they thought was shaky. And it was all people who were on death row, had been convicted, had been sentenced, were in their appeals process. And these students did research, went out and asked people questions, and found the perp, you know, found the person who did it in each case.
So that connects then poverty with not, you know, not having the available quality defense team to be able to do that kind of work.
Yeah. And I think that people like me who are in the business get cynical. You know, and you think all of your clients are guilty, and so you quit working for it. And that's really dangerous, because all your clients are not guilty.
And is there not something in the system where there is a rotation for, if you can't afford an attorney, there is a rotation of attorneys who are simply assigned to death penalty
right.
cases, whether or not they have any experience?
And that varies state by state. The state statutes
control
that.
Way in Texas.
Yeah.
And so in Illinois, you would get someone who had experience, but you wouldn't in every state.
In Washington, too, you have to be death qualified.
Yeah. And that standard is increasingly coming into the states, although there's this whole death belt in the South where it's still, like in the 18th century or something. But the Supreme Court is upholding that requirement over and over again these days, so it's getting to be a higher standard for what will stand. So if you can get someone to take your appeal and to appeal you on up, you may get overturned just on the fact that your attorney was incompetent. However, I have some very horrifying stories about incompetent attorneys. And that does go to the poverty thing here. We're done?
Yeah, we are.
I'm sorry.
One more story.
All right, one more story. I'm going to do place real quick. One of the many ways that the system is inequitable, and if you think the death penalty is okay to do, at least you would want it to be applied fairly. Some of the things we've been talking about are about the injustices or unfair things about it. And there are fair ways that it's done too, as we've been hearing. But one of the things about it is place. If you commit a crime and you're charged with murder and the penalty that they're asking for is death, in Houston, you're very likely to get it. But if you do the same crime, you're not going to get it in Dallas. because every county is different, not even every state. Three quarters of the death cases in Texas are tried out of Houston. And, you know, very few out of the other places in Texas. So if you do a crime in Manhattan, you are going to not be charged with a capital case. If you do it in Staten Island, you will be. So it's not even state to state, although state to state, of course, does matter. I mean, I'd much rather get caught on a state case in Minnesota than I would in Illinois, because in Minnesota I couldn't get the death penalty unless it turned into a federal case. But within a state, if one of the reasons that Houston is so bad, if you receive the public defender that gets most of the death cases in Houston, you will join what they call the mock wing, which is a whole wing of the state prison there of death penalty people on death row, because that defender, that public defender, is so bad that this guy Mock is a public defender, all of whose clients get the death penalty. So there's no justice in a million ways, but one of them is place. I'm going to continue this list on Friday and work our way through stories about the death penalty. Thursday, I'm going to talk about the death penalty and our faith, and everybody in the room is going to talk about that.
Really quick, I just wanted, you've probably already seen it, the video, The Exonerated. It's a DVD, it's on DVD, it was a Broadway play. Fabulous if you haven't seen it.
It is.
To people that were on death row.
It is fabulous.
Very neat.
Thank you, everybody.
Good. Yeah.